Deadlines. Iran calls on the UN Security Council to hold certain states accountable for imposing unilateral sanctions as a method of war to starve innocent civilians. Russia urges Turkey to refrain from launching a military campaign in Syria, warning that such a move could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the situation there. Israel's atrocities sees no limits as a Palestinian teenager is shot dead by the regime's soldiers in the occupied West Bank, the fourth such killing in just 2 days. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has censured the Security Council for failing to fulfill its responsibility with regard to some serious violations of international law, in particular illegal sanctions on Iran. Majid Takht-e Ravanchi told the council that certain states are using coercive measures as a method of war to starve innocent civilians. He underlined that the U.S. has targeted Iran with the most severe economic and financial sanctions, which directly endanger the lives of the vulnerable population. The Iranian ambassador said the sanctions have even caused the deaths of some Iranian patients, including children, as a result of restrictions on medicine and medical supplies. He was addressing an open debate at the UN Security Council on strengthening accountability and justice for serious violations of international law. Political commentator Jim Kavanaugh says the sanctions warfare is at the heart of the current U.S. foreign policy.
The foreign policy of the United States now is based on sanctions. It's based on coercion and threats. And we've seen this before. Look, it happened in Iraq. And Madeleine Albright is famous in the 90s for saying it was worth the price of 500,000 children, dead children, to sanction for the sanctions on the Saddam Hussein, you know, that went on for years and caused, she acknowledged, 500,000 dead children. So the United States now has a policy pursuing a foreign policy of sanctions, sanction warfare and siege warfare against countries that it wants to discipline. And, you know, like with Russia now and like with Iran, nothing Iran's going to do is going to stop these sanctions. The sanctions aren't going to stop until and unless Iran comes into compliance with the American and Israeli hegemony in the region. And Iran isn't about to do that. So, you know, that's really what it's about. And they're punishing them for not being compliant with American and Zionist program for the region. And Iran is a very powerful country and a strong and a big country. And they need to kind of cut it down if they can.
Well, Iran's health ministry says there have been no COVID-19 related deaths over the past day, a remarkable first in the country since the pandemic emerged in 2019. The total number of deaths stands at over 141,000. The ministry recorded 175 new infections in the past 24 hours. Health authorities are attributing the low numbers to the massive vaccination drive. They say the intensive nationwide campaign is now paying off. So far, nearly 150 million doses have been administered across the country, and nearly 60 million Iranians have been fully inoculated. China has warned any confrontational moves at the upcoming meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors will only undermine cooperation between Iran and the agency and disrupt the negotiation process on the revival of the 2015 deal. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman made the comments after reports said the US, the UK, France, and Germany had prepared a draft resolution to push the Board of Governors to rebuke Iran at the board's June the 6th meeting. Zhao Lijian said exerting pressure on Iran and the UN agency will escalate tensions and complicate the situation. He called on Washington to make a political decision as soon as possible on the revival of the agreement known as the JCPOA. The official urged the White House to actively respond to what he called Iran's legitimate concerns and work towards an early consensus on outstanding issues. Political commentator Alfred DeZayas says the United States, Britain and Israel manipulate UN agencies like the IAEA in an attempt to achieve their anti-Iran goals.
Well, double standards are not uncommon in the UN system. And UN reports are not always balanced. They are subject to being weaponized against certain countries and not against others. Now, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT of 1970, as you know, there are 191 states bodies. Iran is the state body. Not, however, Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea. So it's not universal. And Article 10 of the NPT would allow Iran to denounce the treaty if it wants to, if it feels that its national security is at stake. Now, nobody wants that. United States intelligence services, United Kingdom, Israeli, we all work hand in hand. They have one goal, and that is to have regime change in Tehran. So anything that might destabilize, anything that might, shall we say, diminish the influence of Iran in world affairs is welcome. And for that purpose, you use whatever agencies, United Nations agencies and other agencies, and of course, the media.
Russia urges Turkey to refrain from launching an offensive into northern Syria, saying it could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the already difficult situation. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said such a move would be a direct violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Maria Zakharova added that an incursion by Turkey would cause a further escalation of tensions in Syria. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has renewed threats of a military offensive in northern Syria. He says Ankara wants to establish a 30-kilometer security zone along its southern border. Erdogan claims the military campaign aims to target terrorists. Turkey has launched three incursions into Syria since 2016 under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Damascus has repeatedly slammed Turkey for its illegal presence in Syria, saying Ankara is supporting terrorists in the north of the country. A Palestinian teenager shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, the fourth such killing in only 2 days. The Palestinian Health Ministry said the 17-year-old boy, Oda Mohammed, was killed with a bullet into his chest near the village of Al-Madiya, west of Ramallah. Israeli regime forces killed two Palestinians on Wednesday and another this morning. At least six Palestinians have also been injured over the past 24 hours. In the meantime, hundreds of people held funerals for two of the Palestinians killed on Wednesday. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the International Criminal Court needs to break its silence over Israel's crimes.
The Israeli regime is pressing ahead with its barbaric violence against Palestinians. Israeli military forces have shot and killed a Palestinian woman in the southern part of the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the 31-year-old victim as Gufran Harun Hamed Warasne. The Tel Aviv regime claims the woman was trying to stab Israeli soldiers, but witnesses say that Warasne posed little threat to the soldiers. She has started a new job at a radio station 3 days prior to being killed.
This woman was apparently also a journalist, starting her first day of work. And it's hard for me to believe that this was someone attacking Israelis. This is an excuse. If they produced a knife, I can't imagine that it was the woman who had the wife. It was produced by the Israelis themselves.
The incident happened close to the Al-Arub refugee camp, located 15 kilometers south of Bethlehem. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said the Israeli forces prevented his medical staff from attending to Warasne. They only managed to attend her 20 minutes after she was injured. The killing comes amid rising tensions between Palestinians and Israeli forces in the occupied territories. Local and international rights groups have condemned what they call Israel's excessive use of force and shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians.
They're being protected. The Israelis are being protected in the U.S. and most likely the rest of the Western countries. So are they being reckless? Well, if you live in a part of the world where you get the full information, yes, I think you could say that they're being reckless. But in fact, they're being permitted to continue their genocide and their recklessness without being held to account. This is the problem.
Israeli forces have been busy killing or injuring Palestinians, especially from the holy month of Ramadan onwards. But the Palestinians are not sitting idle either. Over the past 2 months, resistance fighters have also ramped up attacks against Israelis, which have left 18 settlers dead. That represents an unprecedented number since the Second Intifada in 2005.
In recent weeks, Israel has stepped up its provocative moves against Palestinians. Far-right Israeli extremists, supported by the regime, have just held the controversial flag march in Al-Quds. Israelis raided in and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The march was aimed at celebrating the occupation and subsequent annexation of East Jerusalem in 1967, a move that has not been recognized by the international community. Some chanted racist slogans, including death to Arabs, and attacked Palestinian residents while backed by armed Israeli forces. Dozens of Palestinians were arrested across Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank a day earlier.
Well, everyone is asking that. And given the incitement that the Israelis are causing, the deliberate attempts to provoke Palestinians and to cause trouble and violence against Palestinians, then yes, it's very possible that the Palestinians will participate in an uprising. You could say there's an uprising right now against Israeli violence and provocations.
It's believed that Israel is deliberately fanning the flames of violence across the occupied territories. The clashes at Al-Quds had sparked fears of another armed conflict, similar to an 11-day war in May last year, between Israel and the Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas.
It's, until now, at a relatively low level, but it could get, if it becomes really popular, and then the Palestinians could make a major major uprising against the Israelis. And frankly, it's one of the few things that might bring the kind of attention to them that they really need. The world needs to look at it. And as I told you, here in the U.S., we're not getting that view unless we know where to look.
Back in May, Israeli forces killed Al Jazeera TV correspondent Shirin Abu Akhleh while she was covering a military raid on the northern city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured and raised by Israeli forces and settlers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan.
While Russia has not revealed its casualty figures for some time now, the Ukrainian government is admitting huge losses in the east of the country. Johnny Miller reports.
Russia is currently pounding the Donbass with its overwhelming air and artillery superiority. On the ground, Ukrainian soldiers post videos on social media from underneath the barrage. With each passing day, the odds of these soldiers surviving dwindles. As President Zelensky today made the staggering statement that between 60 and 100 Ukrainian soldiers are dying every day, with another 500 wounded.
As this conflict began, many voices around the world said that it was NATO's plan to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. Well, many Ukrainian units now are refusing to head into the hellstorm that is currently the Donbass, and as they say, to face certain death.
In an underreported phenomenon, in the last week I've seen more than half a dozen videos posted by Ukrainian units in which they declare they are refusing to fight. They say they are not being adequately trained or equipped, that their commanders are not going with them, and that they are being used as cannon fodder. This is the 115th Brigade. After refusing to fight, they were arrested for desertion. I have also seen videos of women in Ukraine protesting the predicament of their sons and husbands.
The Ukrainian armed forces can largely be categorized into three separate groups. First of all, you have the far-right, in some cases neo-Nazi militias, who do have some influence over Ukrainian politics, but are also ideologically driven to fight the Russians. You then have the well-trained soldiers, Ukrainian soldiers, often trained in NATO countries, who are also, judging by various social media posts, bolstered, their ranks being bolstered by foreign mercenaries, in particular some former special forces fighters of NATO countries. They, of course, are highly trained and highly motivated. Then you have the National Guard, who are largely conscripted from the reserves. They are not very well trained, they haven't had fight experience, and they're far less motivated to fight. It's from these groups that these posted videos are coming from.
This is Eduard Basurin, the deputy commander of the Donetsk People's Republic, who are fighting alongside the Russians.
The situation in Ukraine was being developed for one thing, to destabilize the Russian Federation. They are interested in this destabilization lasting for as long as possible, hoping that the citizens of Russian Federation will get tired. That's why they are interested in fighting to the last Ukrainian. So I have pity for the people in Ukraine. They are being eliminated, and I don't see the end of it. It's a big tragedy.
An apartment in Odessa. Military summons are plastered all over it. And here, another summons. In order to make up for their huge losses, Ukraine is increasingly calling up its reserves. And since the beginning of Russia's invasion, men of military age are not allowed to leave the country. While Ukrainian government propaganda relentlessly claims that the fight for Donbass is worth it, many Ukrainians would rather live in peace, even if it means territorial concessions. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
That report brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we spoke about Imam Khomeini's arrest in 1963 by the notorious organization SAVAK. As you know, we try to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saqafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. If you remember, it was said that the news of Imam Khomeini's arrest resonated like a bomb throughout the country, and people from all walks of life poured to the streets of cities to protest the Pahlavi regime's act. But the regime, instead of listening to the national demand, massacred thousands of people in various cities and towns. This time, we are going to touch upon the events after the arrest of Imam Khomeini. You also heard that the people of Qom would gather around the house of Imam Khomeini to reduce the psychological pressure of the Imam's family, yet they would be soothed by the patient family of the beloved leader. Today we are going to continue the events in the aftermath of Imam Khomeini's arrest. Stay tuned, please. After the arrest of Imam Khomeini on June 4, 1963, he was taken directly to the officers' barracks in Tehran and then to Qasr prison. The Imam was then transferred to another prison in a barracks after 19 days. However, he stayed there only one day as he was jailed at a solitary confinement. During the beloved leader's imprisonment, the regime agents very much tried to break his morale through interrogation, but to no avail, as the Imam would keep silent. During Imam Khomeini's imprisonment in Tehran, a few scholars like his elder brother, Ayatollah Pasandide, were allowed to visit him, but the Savak agents didn't let the Imam's wife to visit him. On the third day of the Imam's stay in prison, it became clear that he wouldn't eat the food of the prison due to temperamental reasons, so his family was allowed to prepare the food and sent it to him. The Imam's venerated wife says, "We hadn't heard of the Imam in the first days, and I was very worried. After being informed of his prison, we would take him food. I mean, we would prepare the food at my mother's house and Mashhadi Ali would take it to Ashratabad prison." After nearly 1 month, Imam Khomeini was transferred from this prison to the house of a man called Abbas Nejati. The event caused zeal and hustle among the people as they swarmed around the Imam's residence to visit him. Ms. Saghafi relates as follows. A few days after the Imam's stay at Mr. Nejati's home, the conditions of Dawoodiya neighborhood and Shemiran Street quite changed. There were police agents on horse. They had stood there with their special gesture while people were sitting at sidewalks and the cars moving on the street were a means of propaganda against the system of oppression. The government noticed how badly the conditions were going on, thus it decided to transfer the Imam to another place. One of the emulators of the Imam, called Mr. Rouhani, overtook the responsibility of Imam's stay and the Imam stayed at his home for 2 months, while under the Savak house arrest. A house was also rented for us near there in Qaitariye. We started the new life and spent the winter over there without any heater. The Imam came to us after 2 months. It was a cold winter and it would snow very much. We were in shortage of quilts and mattresses. During those months, no one would think that the person who was the symbol of a struggle against the Shah would face so much hardship. The Savak's control was so tight on Imam Khomeini and his family as they were scared of his influence among people. But after a while, they decided to release the Imam under certain conditions. The regime was insisting on returning the Imam to Qom by the Savak agents to imply that he had reconciled with the regime and retreated from his stance. But Imam Khomeini didn't accept the decision and put some of his belongings on the seat beside him and didn't let any of the regime agents to accompany him. Lady Saghafi continues, "The regime agents came and said to Imam, 'You are free.' As the Imam saw that the Savak head had come, he said, 'If I am supposed to go to Qom with you, I'd better stay here. I prefer the imprisonment here to the freedom while your agents accompany me.' He had realized that they wanted to enter Qom beside him to show to the people that there were no differences anymore and there were friends with the Imam. Imam Khomeini was not content even with this. When they saw the Imam's insistence, they accepted that nobody would accompany the Imam in the car. To prevent anyone from sitting by him in the car, the Imam told us, 'Give me that samovar and rug. I want to take them to Qom.' The rug and samovar were taken to Qom with the Imam. Perhaps the Imam wanted to break their palm." The course that the Savak agents chose for taking the Imam to Qom would remind of an attempt on his life. The Imam's wife relates, "The agents followed the Imam's car by another car." The Imam said, "They were taking me through alleys. First I thought that they might finish off me, but as we turned to Hazrat Abdul Azim Road, I realized that they had taken me from outside the city so that the people couldn't see me." On the Tehran-Qom road too, one of the Savak agents pointed to the narrow route leading to the Salt Lake. I thought that they would kill me. I asked the Imam later, "How did you feel at that moment? Did you fear?" He answered, "By God, I didn't fear even at the time that they were taking me to the prison. I said, okay, they will take and kill." Imam Khomeini's return to Qom turned his house to the center of popular gatherings and political-religious debates. Ms. Saghafi says, "The Imam went to Qom and I returned whatever I had borrowed to the owners and set out for Qom the day after. I entered the house from where the Imam had been abducted. I mean Mustafa's house, which was opposite our house. The house was full of people. The political issues in this house were deeper than before, as we had more experiences. Once religious issues were raised, but today the government had raised the issues which would confront the religion and were followed by the uprising of the ulema. Today it was the Imam who would tell them what to do, what not to do."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. We're proud to bring you this show only on IRB English Radio. And of course, in the studio, as always, I have my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamini. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Dear Zainab, happy to be here.
I'm totally excited to have you with us again so we can continue our active discussion that we left off from last episode. It was regarding women's health and the parents' pre- and post-pregnancy diet, the things that they should take into consideration, the steps that they should take, and the cautions that they should be aware of. And I think we're basically just focusing on mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
In regard with this huge transition in a person's life, becoming a parent and bringing life into this world. And Sister Desia, last episode, are we going to have a recap? Do you want to have...
Sure.
Let's go over what we talked about.
Well, this topic is very comprehensive. Mm-hmm. Or very... It's multidimensional. So you have so many things to talk about. Okay. Basically, we're talking about the Muslim lady, mm-hmm. and I can all never just really have a clear border between family, child raising, and the Muslim lady. Mm-hmm. They are so interwoven. Mm-hmm. Seriously, you can't really distinguish one from the next. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, we're talking about a lady who is planning to become pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, all these issues will have to be a couple's concern from even pre-spouse selection phase.
Yeah.
Where, because, you know, like you can't, if you want to fix one piece, you can't really expect to change the whole picture. I mean, everything, it's like family is a system where all the pieces of the puzzle, they have to be together in order to give you a shape, to give you a good picture, a good scene.
So there has to be a harmony. Basically.
Exactly. Between all the pieces of the puzzle and all the gears in this machine,
the
right?
The ridges and the corners and the different shapes, they have to fit in together.
Exactly. And if one starts moving, the rest, they have to like follow in harmony.
And circulate.
Exactly. So that's why today I thought we should talk a little about things that people should consider from, you know, pre-spouse selection. Of course, some people are at the phase that they're already married and they're planning to have a child, and this is like the preconception era of their mm-hmm. life. But some other listeners and audience that we have who are following us are thinking of getting married. And they are so far-sighted that they actually have in mind that the future father of my children or the future mother of my children, how will they be? Because if you remember, in our previous episodes, we did talk about the fact that one of the rights of the child upon the father is to choose a good name to teach that child the Quran and to choose a good mother for the child.
Mm.
So you see, Islam has this into consideration that if you want, that fatherhood starts all far beyond, before even the stage of getting married or selecting your spouse. So that is why I just want to shift your attention to the phase where you are, you have to, what, you know, the Islamic guidelines and principles that we have if we want to choose a proper partner for our life, whom will be the future father or mother of my child.
Mm. So that is definitely a very, very serious discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to raise more awareness regarding this matter among the youth, especially because it literally changes the course of their lives and the lives of the future generations. We cannot imagine how significant this process of choosing a spouse is.
It is so hugely, hugely significant. You know, sometimes I say that, well, some people will say, well, I will try to make my best decision in life in choosing my partner. But then if things don't work out, I can get a divorce.
Mm.
But then the consequences of this divorce, they're so huge that it will impact your life until the end of it.
Mm.
So you have to be so careful, especially when there's a child in the picture.
Yeah, definitely.
And everything becomes so catastrophic and it's a lose-lose situation.
It really is. And my heart really goes out to children who are from broken families.
They are.
Because the poor baby, she or he did not choose to be in this situation. And they're here now. And even though the parents really do, most parents, I've seen parents that really don't do their best. But for those who do, they are. But at the end of the day, how much resources can they possibly have? They're just as broken and traumatized from this event as the baby.
Exactly.
And it's really sad. Anywho, before I get myself crying and I get my darling guest sentimental over this topic, we're going to quickly and swiftly move forward and talk about the importance of the whole process of spousal selection in order to have a sound, good, fruitful, productive, bountiful, prosperous marriage. And I can't help but think that there's another aspect of this that we need to talk about too, and I'm pretty sure we are, I feel in my guts. And I think we've discussed this before this show. We talked about the material aspect of taking care of ourselves. I'm pretty sure there's this moral, spiritual aspect of taking care of ourselves too that we need to tackle.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Previously, it was the month of Ramadan that we were recording, and we talked so much about food and nutrition and different kinds of soups and porridges, and you know, it our mouth were starting to water, and we were fasting, and we had a really hard time in the studio. I remember
the things
that
we do for our listeners.
You know, so in many societies, I'm talking about Muslim societies, when somebody comes to you to propose to your daughter, like the first question is that, does he have a house?
Does he have a car?
Does he have a car?
Stable career.
Exactly. Does he work part-time or full-time? And then where's his house? Who are his family?
Which area?
In which area does his parents live? And they barely pay attention to these questions that, what does he do? Like, what kind of behaviors does he have in life? Who does he befriend? Does he value praying? Does he value fasting? Is he a kind-hearted person? Is he a responsible person?
Honest, trustworthy, generous. Right. Oh, my God. A stingy husband is intolerable. Girl, if you're dealing with a stingy husband, honey, my heart goes out to you.
Definitely. And before, you know, giving more instances or examples, we are specifically dealing with the issue of spouse selection as it is related to the topic of childbearing and parenting and, you know, the influence it will have later on in life. There's a beautiful hadith from the Prophet that it says that be very careful, be super cautious on where you place your child, you know, to whom you have relationship with, to in whose womb you place your your sperm, right? Because blood and genes do have a tremendous effect on your child.
Obviously.
So that is why we're going to talk about this topic. So, for instance, in a beautiful hadith from, we're talking about the criterions or standards that a boy and a girl should have in mind when selecting a spouse. Like one of them is whether that person commits acts of corruption or like commits sins outwardly without having any shame, right? Like going to discos or having a girlfriend or drinking and, you know, things like that. And there's a beautiful hadith from Imam Ridha alayhi salam that states that beware not to give your daughter's hand in marriage to a person who's a drunkard, right? So like one of the criteria is that. And then there's the question that some people might have had a really bad past in their lives and then they have changed. And you're wondering, you know, whether I should choose this guy or girl as my spouse to be. And then they're like, you have to see if they have stopped that kind of lifestyle, corruptive lifestyle in the past, and they are very sorry about that previous life that they had, and they're really struggling to make up for the shortcomings or for the past dark page in their life that they have had.
Right.
If this is the case, then it's totally okay to proceed with the case. Otherwise, if you tell the guy, so, you know, you've done this and that. Now, what do you think about it? You're like, Well, we're humans and we're young people and we only live once.
Exactly.
That's the approach.
Yeah.
Well, girl, one very important, so we talked about the fact that he shouldn't outwardly commit corruption, right? Mm. The second one, like one instance of which was to drink, to be an alcoholic.
Even an alcoholic, someone who is...
Who has the habit of drinking.
Exactly.
Right?
Or just even not a habit, just... You know, allows himself to even get close to alcohol or associate with groups that drink alcohol. I mean, as a Muslim, that's like a red line for
us. Exactly. That's a no zone,
yeah.
Right? In the picture of the Muslim family, you have a manager, الرجال قوامون على النساء. I'm giving you the larger picture. And then you have the executive manager who... works, who is a counselor of the main manager and works in harmony with him. You know, I'm talking about the lady of the house. And basically, if we believe that the man is to be the provider, I mean, the material provider for his family, and it's like he's him doing jihad when he's providing. So basically, the person who stays at home and who has more free time to do the child raising under the guidance and supervision of the master or the principal is the lady of the house. So this kind of family would function only when this guy is a faithful person, has iman. I'm not just talking about just the mere act of praying, and then once he finishes praying, he would do anything.
Yeah.
A kind of God fear, a kind of taqwa, self-care against sins in all aspects of his life, whether it's in his behavior towards his wife or his children or his parents or his co-workers or his environment. This faith has to shine in all aspects. The rays of faith have to be reflected in his actions and in his treatment towards the others that are around him.
And that was a very interesting discourse about this very significant, crucial, and life-changing topic, spousal selection, here on Muslim Lady. Inshallah ta'ala, thank you, Sister Razia. We'll be discussing this matter in further episodes. Make sure to tune in and join us on our talk about spousal selection and the criteria we have to take into consideration when choosing a life partner. Until then, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Allahu Akbar.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. House leaders' support for incumbent Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar over progressive lawyer Jessica Cisneros in Texas elections have left progressives seething. We have prepared for you an article written by Joanne Grieve. The piece is titled Progressives Take Aim at U.S. Democratic Leadership Over Support for Centrist Candidates. Texas officials have still not declared a winner in the state's 28th congressional district, where incumbent Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar currently leads progressive lawyer Jessica Cisneros by 175 votes out of roughly 45,000 ballots cast. But as progressives wait to see who will win the runoff race, they cannot help but think of what might have been if House Democratic leaders had not come to Cuellar's assistance. Henry Cuellar secured the endorsements of the top three U.S. House Democrats, and the congressman's campaign was also propped up by millions of dollars in super PAC spending aimed at attacking Jessica Cisneros. Progressives complained that House leaders' intervention in primaries like Henry Cuellar's is making it harder for their candidates to succeed, and they worry about the repercussions of the party embracing centrist candidates with controversial stances on issues like abortion rights and gun control. The potential victory of Henry Cuellar recently, who has previously received an A rating from the National Rifle Association, is all the more painful for progressives given the recent mass shooting incident at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. The massacre, which unfolded roughly 100 miles away from Henry Cuellar's district, claimed the lives of 19 children and two teachers. Hours after the shooting last Tuesday, 24th of May, progressives watched with dismay as Henry Cuellar crept ahead of Jessica Cisneros in the vote count. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez vented her frustration at House leaders for aiding Henry Cuellar, attacking her colleague's policy positions and his potential involvement in an FBI investigation. Cuellar's home and campaign office were raided in January, but the congressman has denied wrongdoing, and his attorney claimed he was not the target of an investigation. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said on Twitter, "On the day of a mass shooting and weeks after news of Roe, Democratic Party leadership rallied for a pro-NRA, anti-choice incumbent under investigation in a close primary. Robocalls, fundraisers, all of it." Adding, "Accountability isn't partisan. This was an utter failure of leadership." Progressives see a pattern in how party leaders and center-left groups are targeting their candidates in primaries. In Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district, super PACs spent millions of dollars trying to prevent the nomination of State Representative Summer Lee, although the progressive lawmaker ultimately won her primary. Democratic Congressman Kurt Schrader, who had attracted criticism for blocking key parts of Joe Biden's agenda, still won the president's endorsement and secured the backing of House Democrats' campaign arm, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Kurt Schrader officially lost his primary to progressive challenger Jamie McLeod Skinner on Friday, 27th of May. Progressives argue that Jessica Cisneros would have easily cruised to victory as well if the Democratic establishment, particularly House leaders, had not invested so heavily to assist Henry Cuellar. In the weeks leading up to Tuesday's election, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi recorded a robocall for Henry Cuellar, while Majority Whip Jim Clyburn travelled to Texas to campaign alongside his colleague. Waleed Shaheed, communications director for the progressive group Justice Democrats, said, "With a margin this small, it's clear that a pro-choice, anti-NRA Democrat could have easily won if it wasn't for the full-throated support of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the party establishment in Washington for anti-choice, pro-NRA Henry Cuellar." Waleed Shaheed added, "Why is all of Democratic Party leadership more heavily focused on defeating an anti-NRA, pro-choice Democrat than defeating Republicans in the midterm elections?" But allies of House leader Nancy Pelosi and Majority Whip Jim Clyburn see nothing nefarious in their actions to help candidates like Henry Cuellar, given that endorsing incumbents has long been a standard practice for party leaders. Antoine Seawright, a Democratic strategist who serves as a senior advisor to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, claimed House leader's strategy was practical as the party attempts to hold on to its narrow majority in the chamber. Republicans only need to flip a handful of seats to regain control of the House, and they're heavily favored to do so, given historical trends and President Biden's underwater approval rating. Antoine Seawright said, "At the end of the day, it's about 218. That's the number of votes needed on any given day to get anything done. This is all about preserving and keeping the majority." The shifting politics of Henry Cuellar's district also adds more complexity to the race. Texas's 28th congressional district, which covers the eastern outskirts of San Antonio and stretches down to the U.S.-Mexico border, was previously considered a Democratic stronghold. But the district has become more conservative in recent years, and election forecasters consider it to be a toss-up race for November. With a difficult general election ahead, some Democrats say a more conservative member of the party, like Henry Cuellar, who has held the seat since 2005, may have a better chance at winning. Antoine Seawright said, "Mr. Cuellar has been re-elected on many occasions in that district, and I think that means that the voters of that district, Democrats, Republicans and Independents alike, have made the decision that he's a person they want representing their interests in Washington." But supporters of Jessica Cisneros' campaign take issue with that argument. Ezra Olive Lieberman, the electoral organizer in Texas's 28th congressional district for the climate group Sunrise Movement, said Jessica Cisneros would be the stronger candidate in the general election because of her ability to energize and mobilize young voters. Since Sunrise endorsed Cisneros last year, the group has made more than 700,000 calls to support her campaign. Ezra Olive Lieberman said, "We've been knocking doors in 100-degree Texas heat because we're excited about and inspired by the vision that Jessica Cisneros is fighting for that says we don't have to live in fear of gun violence, that we can have freedom to make decisions about our own bodies." Looking ahead to the general election, Ezra Olive Lieberman added, "It's going to be hard and we need a grassroots base to win. And I think Democratic leadership is squandering any hope of us winning by alienating young people." Ezra Olive Lieberman noted that young voters helped elect Joe Biden and secure the party's majorities in Congress, and he accused House Democratic leaders of ignoring the needs of a key constituency. Olive Lieberman said, "It's so abundantly clear what young people want and how Democratic leadership is willing to do the exact opposite. I feel really angry that we have put so much into fighting for a better world and to try to put a stop to so many of the crises that we're facing. And it feels like the people who are standing in the way of that are people who supposedly are on our side." Olive Lieberman and Jessica Cisneros, other supporters, have said they will fight to get every vote counted in Texas's 28th congressional district, expressing hope that Henry Cuellar can still be defeated. But regardless of the outcome in Texas, progressives are encouraged by the victories they have already seen in primaries this year with candidates like Lee and McLeod Skinner. They are ready to keep up the fight even if Democratic leaders attempt to stand in their way. Ezra Olive Lieberman said, "If anything, I think this primary season so far is just emboldening our movement to build more power, to keep going to get stronger." He added, "And we know that the establishment is scared."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.